Now, an armed assailant shot 13 people at a supermarket in Buffalo, New York over the weekend, leaving 10 people dead.
Most of the victims of the shooting were black, and authorities are investigating the attack as a racially motivated hate crime.
In online posts attributed to him, the accused perpetrator expressed white supremacist and anti-black ideas, including a conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement. Our next guest says that idea was for a while on the fringes, but has become increasingly mainstream.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about domestic extremism in the U.S.? Do you have questions about extremist ideas and how they spread? Have you heard a version of this Great Replacement theory online or on TV? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Cynthia Miller Idris is the director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. It's also called PERIL for short. She's the author of two books on extremism. Her most recent is Hate in the Homeland, the New Global Far Right. Cynthia, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about this great replacement conspiracy theory and where it came from?
Yes. Well, the theory itself, the conspiracy, has roots, obviously, that have been around a long time. So in the U.S. for decades, there's been a conspiracy theory called white genocide, which says that there's an orchestrated plot to eradicate white civilizations. And in Europe, there's been a conspiracy theory called Eurabia, which says that Muslim elites are trying to expand the caliphate through demographic change and immigration. And so these roots have been there for a really long time. But about a decade ago, this conspiracy called the Great Replacement kind of became an umbrella concept on dark spaces online that united sort of white supremacists across the world. And we saw terrorist attacks in Oslo and in Christchurch, New Zealand, and then El Paso, Pittsburgh, here and now in Buffalo, that have all been really mobilized by those same ideas, that it's an orchestrated plot, that it is to gain power, and that there is an existential threat to white people. So it really is circulates in dark spaces online and mobilizes terrorist actors. But over the past couple of years, we've seen it much more frequently show up in mainstream political discourse and on cable news networks as well.
Before we turn to that mainstreaming, can you talk about, is it an informal online network that really promotes and harbors these ideas now online?
Yeah, this is a great question, because it's really hard to explain how networked online extremism works. It is, I think it's exactly the way to describe it, is that it is like a network. These are not lone wolves or lone actors in the sense of completely isolated people out in a cabin somewhere. They are very socially engaged online, but they're not members typically of groups the way that 20 or 30 years ago we would see. And even today, there are extremist groups where people have, initiation rites and membership lists, and you sign up and you're a card-carrying member of an extremist group. That does still exist, but the vast majority of what's happening today is young people, especially spending time, teenagers and young adults, on meme-sharing sites, watching videos in online gaming chat rooms, sharing texts with their friends that have memes or video snippets or jokes that have really racist and misogynist and disgusting kind of content in them, that also that in some of these cases explain that there's a conspiracy or refer to a conspiracy called the Great Replacement. So the terrorist shooter in Christchurch, his manifesto was called the Great Replacement. I mean, this became a kind of unifying, and he live streamed his attack as well, just like the Buffalo shooter did. And so there was a lot of imitation here. Even the Buffalo shooter really plagiarized most of the so-called manifesto. Those 180 pages was plagiarized, the content from the Christchurch manifesto.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at a conspiracy theory, the replacement, great replacement theory cited by the alleged perpetrator of the Buffalo shooting. She says it's getting more mainstream, though. And you could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. You could tell us if you've encountered this. Now, you mentioned, Cynthia, you're seeing this more, a version of this more in American politics and media. I want to listen to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican from Wisconsin. He was talking here about immigration at the U.S.-Mexico border on Fox News last year.
This administration wants complete open borders, and you have to ask yourself why. Is it really they want to remake the demographics of America to ensure that they stay in power forever? Is that what's happening here? Because the human depredations that's being caused by their policies, they're just untold.
Senator Johnson made a similar statement last month in a radio interview. I think Republicans and some on the media, including Tucker Carlson, are saying, wait, we're saying something different than this replacement theory in its classic form. Their argument is Democrats want to allow immigrants in, give them amnesty and let them vote. Amnesty, of course, wouldn't let them vote. But that's the basic idea. How strong a connection do you see between those two versions?
I would say the mainstream version of it is it's an echo of the darker terrorist version of it. And it shares features. So there's still a plot, there's still orchestration, there's some kind of conspiracy to do it. And it's positioning the change that's coming, a demographic change, as a terrible outcome. It's often using dehumanizing language against immigrants, referring to dirty or poor immigrants, for example. We hear that sometimes in the same context as we hear replacing, and it'll use language like traditional America is being replaced, instead of talking about going straight to the issue of race. There's a lot of euphemisms. It's softer, and they're not calling for violence. That's a really important distinction. So, but it creates a bridge, I think, is a way of thinking about it, or an echo. So when someone is encountering the dark version of this online, and then maybe their parents are listening to a cable, listening to Fox News in the background, or they hear somebody at the dinner table mention the similar kinds of things, that's where the potential, I think, for reinforcement comes in.
Now, of course, the worst case is an attack like the one we saw in Buffalo this weekend. How do you see that happening? Someone going from being exposed to these ideas, then embracing them, and then acting on them in this horrific burst of violence?
Well, there's very little research that tells us actually what makes one person who is radicalized become violent and take that leap to violence while another person does not. So, that's really tricky. You can actually only look at it afterward, but there are some key elements that people share in common across violent actors. And one is that they often position themselves as being heroic. So they believe they're saving somebody, their people, or that they are called upon to act as martyrs. And so at some point they've encountered bad content online, often shared from, in a text chat with a group of friends from school or a meme, or they go to these, chan sites or in an online gaming chat where they're encountering these ideas. Somebody shares a hyperlink. I mean, this is the way the ecosystem works online, that takes them to another video. And then the algorithm recommends videos that other people have watched. And that can lead them darker and darker and sort of deeper into a rabbit hole of propaganda. And there's been pretty good coverage showing that that can happen pretty quickly, even within the span of a few days. If you're in a binge watching period, you can encounter content that later gets banned, right? Because the content moderation is always slower and people do see stuff. So, but then once people believe this, they really deeply believe the conspiracy theory, what typically mobilizes them to action is some combination of wanting to be a part of something bigger and better than themselves. They think that they're acting to save their people, or they really want a sense of power and they want to be admired or imitated by others. And we really saw that very clearly here in this Buffalo case, where he's trying to get others to follow him.
And you offer through your organization, PERL, the Polarization Extremism Research and Innovation Lab, advice for parents and others if they worry that a youth in their life, their own kid, may be going down this path. We've got a link at WPR.org/Central Time, some of those resources. What kind of off-roads are there?
It's a great question. And, we created that Parents and Caregivers Guide at the start of the pandemic when we were watching so many millions of teens and kids go online all the time, and also knew that propaganda was circulating in higher amounts. So we were really concerned about parents and caregivers being kind of now the frontline adults who might be able to recognize warning signs. So the first thing we advise parents to do is try to react with curiosity. When you do hear warning signs, when we've had parents say their kids have started expressing extreme misogyny during the pandemic, for example, or they hear their child say something that's Holocaust denial related, you know, or making a joke about something horrific. And often parents react with shame and they shame their child. Those aren't our values. And what are you doing? Or they punish them. And that can actually drive kids, especially further online, into spaces where they are then welcomed and celebrated. And people say your parents just are triggered snowflakes who can't take a joke. And things can get worse. So we try to urge parents, it's very hard, but to react with curiosity, to try to treat their kids as experts, ask them, where did you find that? Can you explain what a meme is? How does this space work where you spend a lot of time? And trying to draw them out and then start to disentangle what is underneath and behind it so they can start to kind of understand.
We're talking to Cynthia Miller-Idris, professor and director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University. We're looking at extremist ideology and the potential link to violence.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think misinformation and disinformation play a big role in the spread of these extremist ideas? Do you worry about young people being radicalized online? Have you encountered this in your own life? Should there be more training for adults to spot the warning signs of radicalization? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett.
And I'm Dean Knetter. We're talking about extremism in the U.S. after a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York last week. Cynthia Miller-Idris with American University stays with us.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your comments, maybe your own experiences. If you've encountered these ideas, maybe on social media or elsewhere, 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Bernie is with us in Valders. Bernie, hi.
Hi. I just want to say that, everything old is new again. Yes, we have the internet now, but just give you a brief background to my family. my father was a survivor of Neuen Gamma concentration camp. And he was actually captured by the Germans in Ukraine. He was born in Ukraine, which was then the Second Republic of Poland, sent to Neuen Gamma, which was a slave labor camp. And for a lot of the same reasons, you know, there was just an economic hatred between Ukrainians, Poles, Germans. Of course, we all know the story of the Nazis, but long story short, he came to the U.S., got to the U.S., and people who were brought here as immigrants, refugees after the war, were known as DPs, displaced persons. And, you know, growing up, I heard the term damn DP an awful lot, and I didn't really understand what it was then, but eventually my dad brought us here to Wisconsin because he didn't like what was happening to him. Every time he opened his mouth with his deep Eastern European accent, in the early 60s, somebody accused him of being a communist. We came here, here into Wisconsin, and my dad bought a farm. He'd saved up enough money to buy a farm near Mount Calvary. The local guy who wanted to buy the farm was angry with my dad for buying the farm, and in a conversation with him said the following: our boys went over to Europe and fought and died for your people, and now you come here and you marry our women and take our land.
Bernie, thank you for sharing, obviously, a still painful story. Cynthia, Bernie sees a long history of this suspicion of the immigrant.
There is a long history, and we're hearing, and I hear the pain in Bernie's story and the way that that carried across generations. I mean, when we talk about intergenerational trauma, the kind of trauma that people carry on, when we hear and in hearing the pain in the communities, voices in Buffalo right now, is so palpable too. And feeling, that, you know, that it's really important to not just pay attention here to the perpetrators of hate and harm and violence and terrorism, but also to how we direct resources to survivors and to victims and to communities who are the most harmed, by those actions.
Bernie, thanks for sharing your family's story at 800-642-1234. Jackie joins us next in Illinois. Jackie, hello. Are you there, Jackie? Oh, we lost Jackie. Jackie had said they don't agree that Fox News necessarily spreads replacement theory. They view themselves as a Fox viewer, but not a supporter of the great replacement theory. And I think looking at Fox News in particular, Cynthia, there is a news division. There are reporters. It's not necessarily wall to wall on the network. People have focused attention on the highly rated Tucker Carlson show in particular.
No, that's right. And, you know, and I do think it's important to distinguish between the great replacement conspiracy theory that's mobilizing terrorist violence and the versions of it that we're hearing on Fox News and from mainstream politicians, but also to recognize the harm. I mean, it is being celebrated by white supremacists online that it's being mentioned on Fox News and by Tucker Carlson. So we're using words like ally and saying, finally, you know, he's saying it. So it is seen as legitimizing within those spaces. And I think it's really important to understand that and to disavow it. And to speak out against it. So I'm glad to hear, you know, hear him say that he is not a supporter of the Great Replacement. I think we should be hearing more people say that.
Even if the transmission of the Great Replacement theory doesn't lead to acts of violence, do you worry about it doing harm in other ways?
Yeah, I mean, it is, even if it's not violent, you know, we want a society. We are a country that has absorbed millions of immigrants, and that has, you know, that has been a place where people seek out opportunities, and we want that to be, you know, to continue to be the case. And so, even when it doesn't mobilize violence, it mobilizes, it has discriminatory and racist and dehumanizing ideas attached to it that give people a sense of threat, that make them feel that they are, in danger, or that there is potential harm coming to their family or their traditions or their lives. And so I think one of the questions we should be asking is, you know, why is it a threat? Why is demographic change being perceived as such a threat? What does it take for everyone who lives in a country to feel at home in the place where they live?
Talking to Cynthia Miller Idris from the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, looking at far-right conspiracy theories and extremism. Cynthia, I want to spend our last few minutes looking at solutions. You've called for what you call a public health approach to violent extremism. What would that look like?
Well, you know, most of our allies overseas treat domestic extremism as a societal problem, not just a security problem. We in this country have framed this problem around the Department of Homeland Security, which, you know, has done a lot with what they have to prevent things, but it makes it really more about, you know, screening and safety and sort of barricading the doors and training people to disarm in a crisis, right? And of course, you want some of that crisis training, and we have seen it be successful in places like the Colleyville hostage taking situation, where that rabbi was able to get away by using that training. But, you know, the way I often describe it is, I don't want to live in a world where barricading the doors is all that we can do, is that's our measure of success. And I don't think anybody wants to live that way. So we want to prevent. A public health approach is saying, we treat this the same way that we've treated diabetes or cardiac disease, which is also educate communities about the attitudinal behavioral choices they can make that help them resist propaganda and understand what manipulative rhetoric looks like online, so they can make their own choices with all the freedoms of speech that we have to be safer in our own communities.
Now, we've seen things like the teaching of a race in schools in the U.S. get really politicized. I'm sure you're aware of that. But if kids don't talk about this in schools, are they going to see it, learn about it on the streets, or I guess more notably on the internet?
Yeah, I think that's exactly a really important point, which is that, you know, that there is a lot of information online, especially in these dark spaces, that presents false information about racial differences, that uses geneticists and genetic and eugenicists kind of ways of thinking, that positions racial differences as biological and harmful. And if kids don't learn about racial inequality and the legacies of racial inequality and racism in this country from trusted adults and curriculum that we know about, they are going to go ask those questions and be given answers online. And those answers often are full of propaganda and disinformation in ways that create tremendous harm. So I think of it as inoculating, as protecting, as pre-bunking the disinformation and the harmful content, and safeguarding young people, especially as they spend time online, by equipping them with the skills to be resilient.
Briefly, as we wrap up, given that all these issues are politicized, do you see those things having a chance of happening in schools?
Unfortunately, I think that, you know, we see it takes the deaths of so many people, that a tragedy like this, to have more open conversations now than I feel like we were able to have a week ago about it, where people are starting to understand, I think, the consequences of not having conversations about race in schools. So I do think that we have a chance. I just hope that it doesn't take another tragedy to move the needle further.
Cynthia, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That's Cynthia Miller Idris, director of the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at American University, author of two books about extremism. She was with us today to talk about the Great Replacement Theory and how to counter domestic extremism after the shooting at a Buffalo, New York grocery store.
Coming up.
By the way, you can find resources, thanks Dean, for Peril on youth radicalization for parents, caregivers, educators, and more at WPR.org/centraltime.